Now I am very excited to hear our speaker. I've heard great things about him. Like Nancy was saying, he's got a lot of his pigeons with him. He's got a lot of friends who were calling us and wanting to know the details because they were excited and they were coming down here also. And I'd like to welcome Ben. And I'd also like to welcome Diz T from Tallahassee, Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Lou. Thank you, Lou. You know, before I get started, I'd just like to encourage everybody that's in this fellowship to meet all the people you can. I think that's one of the benefits of this fellowship. Last night, Juanita made arrangements for us to go on this dolphin cruise. And we get over here, and I hear this captain get up here and make this big eulogy about what's going to go on and everything else. And so we just get on the ship and go, and we sit at the back of this great big boat. And all of a sudden, this captain walks back, and he looks at me, and he says, "Diz, how are you?" And I look at him, and I said, "Pretty good. How are you?" And he said, "You don't remember me, do you?" You know, that's one of those questions you just can't answer. I said, "No, I can't place you at all." And I looked at him, he said, "Captain Larry." And I said, "No, I can't place you at all." He said, "You and I used to go to meetings down in Perry, Florida." And I said, "You used to work at a correctional institution down there, didn't you?" And he said, "Yeah, that's me." And I said, "You have a wife named Jan, don't you?" And he says, "Yeah." And he said, "When they retired, they moved over here to Panama City." But see, that's one of the things you get from this fellowship. You know, somebody's going to recognize you somewhere. I'm not really Ed McMahon, by the way. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Diz Titcher. My sobriety date is Cinco de Mayo, 1981. And my home group's the Mustard Seed Group in Tallahassee, Florida. It's one of the best two meetings in the whole world. And my sponsor is a man by the name of Tommy Hicks from Crawfordville, Florida. And Tommy has a sponsor. I want to thank Juanita and the committee for inviting me to participate in this roundup because it's very colorful. But I want to thank Jack Daniels and Jim Beam for making it possible for me to be here. You know, you all met Nancy. Nancy's my American Express card. I don't leave home without her. And we do a lot of things together. But I never took a drink when I was 3 years old. But I always felt like I could have used one. You know, I waited 5 more years before I had my first taste of an alcoholic beverage. And it was given to me by my dad. My dad used to like to sit on the front porch on weekends. And a lot of his friends would drop by. And he had this old oyster can. And he would give it to me and 25 cents and tell me to go across the river to the beer garden and fill it up with draft beer. And if I could come back across that road without dropping any, I got to take me a sip. And when I took that first sip, you know, I felt like I had belonged. I found something that was part of me, and I was only 8 years old. My first resentment I ever had was against my father, because one day when I was about 12 years old, he told me to cut the neighbor's grass. She was a widow lady, Mrs. Robinson, but she had the largest yard in the whole neighborhood. And he told me after I finished cutting not to accept any money for it. And that made me double angry at him because, you know, we didn't have power motors back in those days. We had those old push clickety-click mowers where the wheels made the things turn to cut the grass. So it was pretty tough for a 12-year-old kid. And I missed out one of the best lessons in my whole life was to help other people and don't expect anything in return. And I didn't learn that until I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was also born during the Depression. And when I say that to you, it's a little bit worse than what it is today. I didn't own a pair of clothes of my own until I was about 17 years old. I got hand-me-downs. And a lot of times I can remember going to school where my pants in the back would be gathered up on, you know, the belt, and I would try to hide the best I could because I didn't want anybody to see me. And, you know, I was never as good as you were. I developed all those old beliefs when I was very young. I used to steal beer from beer trucks when I was young. I was very good at it. And, you know, I could take, get a, fill up my pockets and we'd go, and the guys in the neighborhood, I could share with them. So I started out, you know, learning how to steal and to cheat and get angry. Oh, the other thing, when I went to school, I got to know the girls that were very smart. And I'd always sit beside of them because, you know, they had always helped me with my lessons. And I can remember one time I was sitting beside a girl named Patty, and I wasn't prepared for the test at all. So she wrote all the answers down and gave me her paper, and I gave her my paper. And you know, I just signed my name at the top and turned it in. 2 days later, the teacher said, "Diz, you know, your and Patty's paper had exactly the same answers on it." And I said, "Well, we studied together." As if I thought that kind of a lie was going to get me by. But, you know, that's what I did. I tried to put on a facade of all that lying and cheating and stealing and everything. But it came easy to me, too. But I finally got into sports. And I started playing sports. You know, anybody with the name Diz has got to be, you know, have something to do with baseball, right? Well, I was a pitcher. I pitched baseball. And I played football and basketball and ran track. I did everything. But I probably did better at basketball than I did anything else. And even when I was on that team, I never truly excelled because there was two other guys on that team that I believed was better than I was. And so I'd always kind of stay in the background and let them, you know, get to the forefront. Now, unless they were out of the game. Unless they're out of the game, I did almost everything I wanted to do. And so I was given three scholarships to three different universities. One of them was Southern Mississippi over here in Hattiesburg, and another was my hometown, and another one over in Virginia. And I took the one to Southern Mississippi. You know, I was a 17-year-old kid leaving West Virginia for the first time, my parents and everything else, and I got over in Mississippi, and I tell you, after 2 weeks over there, there wasn't any mountains, there wasn't that fresh air, you know, it was sand and flies and all that stuff. And I went and told the coach I had to go home, you know, that I was just homesick. And I went back to West Virginia, and I felt like, well, I'll just get a job because I didn't think I could, you know, pick up on either one of those other scholarships. But my brother, he said, "No, you're going to go to school." And so he took me down to Morse Harvey. That's where I had the other scholarship. And he enrolled me down there, and he paid for my tuition for that first year and our first semester. And then one day as I was walking towards my car, I walked past the basketball coach, and he looked at me and he said, "Hey, what are you doing here?" He said, "I thought you was down in Mississippi." I said, "Well, I got homesick, and I came home, and my brother enrolled me in here." And he said, "Well, come by and see me tomorrow. I want to talk to you." So I went by to see him the next day and dropped in his office. He said, "Listen, he said, I don't have a scholarship available right now, but if you come out for basketball, if you walk on, if you make the team, I'll give you a scholarship in January." So I went home and talked to my dad and my mom about it, and they said, "Well, that's pretty good. You don't have to go to work. You go ahead and play basketball." And so I went ahead and played basketball, and I made the team, and so he gave me January 1st, gave me a scholarship. And but, you know, when I was in school, I got all these fraternities came after you. You know, they had all these fraternity parties, and there's two fraternities I liked pretty much, and so I went to both of their parties. And, of course, you know what they are. All they're doing is drinking and carrying on, and I kind of liked that. You know, it made me feel right at home. And I like one of them. I like one fraternity better than the other. I like the Phi Sigs. And so I committed to the Phi Sigs, and I went through their initiation process and everything else and became a part of that fraternity. But I didn't know it at the time. But when I got in, I found out that they had been reprimanded by the president of the school 5 times for rowdy behavior and public intoxication. My kind of people. And shortly after I went through initiation, they had an event called Sadie Hawkins Day. And it was after a comic strip that a guy named Al Capp had drew about Dog Patch. And the mayor of Dogpatch was a guy by the name of Abner Hawkins. And he had a daughter named Sadie, who wasn't the best-looking woman in town, and he wanted to get her married off. So he declared this special event where all the single men would have to get on a starting line and given a shotgun start, and 15 minutes later, all the single women would be given a shotgun start, and they had been sent off to chase them. And if they caught them before sundown and got them back to the starting line, they had to get married. Well, if you know anything about Dogpatch, in the next holler over, there's a place called Skunk Holler. And Skunk Holler is the home of the Skag Boys. And the Skag Boys were famous for making Kickapoo Joy Juice. Well, when this event came up in the college, for some reason or another, they picked the Phi Sigma Phi fraternity as the Skag Boys. And we was going to represent everybody from Skunk Holler. So we dressed, you know, to the dime of that Skag Boys. So they had this particular event they was going to hold in Coonskin Park. And they set up this facility to be Dogpatch, and so we went over here right around the corner a little bit, and that's where we set up Skunk Holler. And we had two wash tubs. We filled it up with ice, filled up with grain alcohol. We put grape juice in one, we put lime juice in the other. We called one Purple Jesus and called the other one Green Goddammit. You went by and you had two cups from either one of those wash tubs. You started paying back things you never, ever borrowed. And by the time the festivities got on, you know, and the marriage of really Daisy May and Lou Abner and all these other people got concluded, they had a square dance. Well, let me tell you what, the Skag Boys, Kickapoo Joy Juice, we can really twist our partner and do-si-do, and we did all those things, shooting off those guns. And after the event was all over, we went back over at Skunk Holler and we finished drinking the rest of that Kickapoo Joy Juice. And finally, we drank until about 4 o'clock in the morning, and when we got home, you know, cleaned up, and then we got home and slept all day. And by the time we went back to school on Monday, 2 days later, we get another letter of reprimand. One of the boys had put a picnic table up on a railroad track, and we didn't see that anyway, but we got in trouble that way. After that, I was drafted in the Army at during the Korean War and sent to Fort Knox, Kentucky. Now, Fort Knox, Kentucky is 31 miles from Louisville, Kentucky. And Louisville, Kentucky is the home of the Kentucky Derby. There's an old cliche, you know, it's a home of beautiful horses and fast women. No. Fast horses and beautiful women. So, well, one of those two things anyway. But around Louisville, they had 9 distilleries. And on Saturday morning between 9 and 1, they gave a tour of the facility and free samples. And, you know, if you had a good car and you timed everything right, you could make 3 of those facilities, you know, before time was up. You know, normal drinkers don't do things like that, do they? No. Anyway, my days in the Army, I spent at the PX until I made corporal, and then I went to the NCAO club where you could get a double shot of whiskey for 25 cents. And that was just my life. Every time I got off work, that's what I did. I ate and then went over to the NCAO club. But after I discharged from the Army, I came back home, and I had to make up my decision whether I was going back to school full-time or was going to get a job and go to work. And I got discharged in July, so I figured I'd just go ahead and go to work. And so I went to work. But I kept active in my fraternity. I went to night school. And one particular weekend came up when it was a football game, and so my fraternity's building a float. So when I get off work, I'd go down and help them build the float. And we always had beer and drink or somebody doing something around there, and we'd stay there at about midnight and just carry on like that. But anyway, when the parade was going to be on, we had 2 girls that was going to be on the float, and one of them was from my high school that I graduated from. She was a former head majorette there, and I kind of liked her. I kind of looked at her and said, "Hey, you're not too bad." And I said, "How about going out on a date some night?" And so she said, "Okay." And so we went out on the next Saturday night and after the football game and had a good time together. And the thing I kind of liked is she liked to drink the same things I liked to drink. And I said, boy, that's my kind of woman. So our whole life was like that when we was dating, you know, because she could hold her booze pretty good. And so we had a good time together. We went out dancing. We went out to people's houses and played poker or bridge or something like that, or went on picnics. So we had a good time together. And so we got married. And that life continued. You know, when I'd come home from work, you know, we'd sit down at the kitchen table, have a beer, and talk to one another about what was going on and everything else. And life was just wonderful. You know, everything was just going away. You just saw it in the movies. And then she got pregnant. And then my daughter was born, Kimberly Ann. And then when I'd come home, she was never there for me. You know, I'd always have to wait. And so after, you know, a couple of weeks of that and our whole schedule was interrupted, one of the boys said, why don't you come have a beer with us at 5 o'clock? I said, all right, I'll do that. So I started going with them at 5 o'clock and having a beer. And the next day was 2 beers. Next time was 3 beers. You know how the system goes. And first thing you know, I'm getting home late and, you know, dinner's over. Next thing you know, we have another child, and that's Andrew. And the same thing goes on. My perception of that marriage was every time we had a baby, my relegation, I went down. I went down from being number one to number two, number three to number four. And I just, eventually my drinking just got so bad that it interfered in that marriage and just destroyed it, really. The amazing thing about that is when I got divorced and went to the hearing, I really didn't have any feelings whatsoever about that marriage. Not one feeling at all. And I didn't think that was wrong. I just said, oh, okay. That was it. So I went on to, you know, and tried to pick up my life. I tried to do what the judge said I had to do, and I did that. But then I was single, so I started living that single life, and I was... probably carrying on or drinking every single night. I don't think I stopped one single day in my life. And I got some different jobs. I got a job with a discount department store. And believe me, the first day I was hired, I was drinking with the president of the company. And there was a lot of drinking that went on in that company. And almost every time we had managers' meetings, there was a lot of drinking going on in the hotel where we all stayed together. It was just, that's the way life was. And I made my way up to manager, and they transferred me to Morgantown, West Virginia, which is the home of West Virginia University. And I love football. And so I called all my friends and said, hey, we can have a tailgating party now. And we'd tailgate before the party and tailgate after the party, but the one thing I had to do, the responsibility I had to do, is go around and meet all the people in business around our store. And so I did. I went around to Kroger's and met the manager there, and went over to Lowe's and met the manager there, and about four or five other businesses. The next door over here was a Ford garage. I went in and introduced myself to the owner. He introduced me to the sales manager and all the salesmen and everything, so I had a good rapport with them. And the sales manager said, hey, you play golf? I said, sure, I play golf. He said, would you like to play with us someday? And I said, whereabouts? He said, well, we got a little golf course about 24 miles down the road in Preston County. I said, oh, okay, that sounds good to me. What day you want to play? He said, how about Thursday afternoon? I said, Thursday afternoon's fine. He said, you have to drive. I said, oh, all right. So Thursday afternoon, 12 o'clock, I pick him up. We go down the road. He said, pull in here. And there was one of those 7-Elevens. He goes in. He brings back a six-pack. He said, all right, just go on down the highway here. And so he pops him six back, give me one. He takes the other. So we get down to Preston Country Club where it is, and he pulls in. He's got a house on the golf course. I said, wow, this is pretty nice. And by the way, going down, he drank four beers, and I only had two. And so we get in. He pulls out this golf cart, and on the back of this golf cart is this tall cylinder phone cupboard. And I said, what's that? He said, that's a bazooka. I said, oh. And so what you do, you take the cap off the top of it, and you just put cans of beer down in there. And, you know, and you just put about 8 cans of beer in there, put the cap back on it, put it on the back of the golf cart. You go up the first tee and hit the ball, you open the bazooka up and get a can of beer out, and you're both drinking and put the lid back on it. You're drinking all the way around. But we also met another guy there by the name of Red, and he had the same thing on his golf cart. So Red and Billy is over here, and this guy's named Hack. Hack and I playing over here. And that's what we did. Well, you know, around the number 6, we're out of beer. Don't stop Hack. He pulls out behind this house and goes into the back door there, this refrigerator, takes the cap off, fills up that thing from that refrigerator. It's not even his house. It's somebody else's house. And we fill that bazooka back up, you know, and Red comes over and fills up his bazooka, puts it back on the golf cart. We go back and play. Well, we're playing around that golf course, and after we played number 14, and after number 14 was heading to the tee on 15, and Hack turns right and goes underneath these big bushes, and we get through that bush, and I look, and boy, there's the prettiest log cabin back there. There's this mountain stream coming down with just guys turning to a pool. I mean, it's a beautiful setting, and that's Red's house. That's where Red lived. So what you had to do, you had to take your shoes off. And now we go into Red's house, and he's got these great big tall glasses, about like that, about that big around. And he fills them up with ice, and he puts gin in them. And he fills up about halfway with gin and puts some fruit drink on top of that, and he called them shooters. He said, well, we got to have a couple shooters. I said, that's all right with me. Give me a shooter. So we sit down and went out and sat down outside right by that mountain stream. Well, sit there and drink that shooter, and then you go in, you get you another shooter, and you know, and you're sitting out there, and you're just talking, passing the time away. Pretty soon it gets dark. Well, you can't play golf unless you have lights, and we didn't have lights, so we said, well, we got to get home. Well, what we'd had to do is take the golf cart out on the road and get the lights so we can come back to Hack's house. And I had a great evening, you know. I finally had to drive back, and I tell you, it's like driving that car with one eye. You know how you do have to do that. But I managed to get back every time. And that's what our Thursdays was like, you know. Finally, I joined a club, and Hack and Red got me a place on number 7 green that I could rent, a nice little cabin there I could rent for $100 a month. When I go in there, I open the refrigerator up, it's filled up with beer. Just filled up with beer. Must be 4 cases in there. I said, wow, this ain't a bad way to live. You know? So, pretty soon I'm just getting living down there, and the country club has a golf tournament coming up. And it's, you know, it's for all the guys that belong, so I send in my application to play in it. And so it's going to start the next Thursday, so that's fine. So I come down the next Thursday, and I got my clubs out there, and I'm getting all ready to go, you know. And the pro says, Diz, come here a minute. I said, George, I got to tee off here. No, Diz, come here a minute. I said, all right. So I go over, and I said, what do you want, George? He said, Diz, we can't establish a handicap for you. I said, George, what are you talking about? I've been playing golf down here for 1.5 years. You know, I must have played 50 times. He said, Diz, you've never played more than 14 holes. So what they did, they established a handicap for me based on that 14 holes, and I got to play in that golf tournament. I continued that job. And the other thing is I went to a lot of football games. And in West Virginia, they had the state police at the gates because you wasn't allowed to carry any brown bags in there. And they checked women's purses, and they checked your back pocket. They checked everything to make sure you didn't have any whiskey in there. And I said, that's just not right. And so I went back to my store, and I bought a pair of the 735 binoculars, about that tall. I took the tops off of them, and I cleaned everything out of the inside. I lined them real good, you know. And I could put 6 ounces of booze in this and 6 ounces of that and put the cats back on, put around my neck, and I walk right through them state policemen. You know, and everybody said, that's got to be the best idea I've ever seen. Barnoculars. And I said, yeah, but you know, normal people don't do things like that, do they? No, they don't. I stayed at that job, and I really lost the job, and mainly I lost that job because of drinking. But I managed to get one, get a job selling. I got on the road. Now, there on the road is a typical alcoholic's paradise. You know, because you're your own boss. You got an expense account. And most of your customers like to drink. So consequently, you had it made. And so I did. I had made a pretty good living. Like I did that for about 3 years, and I had a good clientele. And one day I went to see one of my customers, and he said, "Diz," he said, "I had a call the other day from so and so company. They're looking for a permanent salesman. It's a good job, and you know, for a guy like you, you only have to have one thing to sell." And I said, "Well, thank you very much. That's real nice of you." And he said, "I told him, gave him your home number and everything, so somebody's going to be in contact with you." And I said, "Okay, thank you." So sure enough, they called me in. And they asked me to send them a resume of what I've done and what kind of lines I had, and I did that. And about 10 days later, I get another call that they've selected three guys to be interviewed by the vice president of the company. And I said, "Okay." I said, "Thank you very much." And then the next Monday morning before I left to go out to work, I got a phone call. It was the secretary of the vice president. And she said, "Mr. Titcher," she said, "Mr. So-and-so is going to be flying in Charleston, West Virginia, and we'd like for you to pick him up. He's going to be arriving about 1:30 on Friday." I said, "Okay, I'll be there and do that." Well, now, there's one thing you never do to an alcoholic is put things in his mind to think about. Because that mere phone call told me that I was probably the number one candidate for that job. And I used that, and I thought about that, and I ruminated about that, that, you know, I don't know why these other guys are going to be interviewed. I mean, you know, this guy's going to take me. So, I mean, I really got kind of cocky and out of it, and anyway, but I was at the airport at 1:30 on Friday. Went in, and his plane was delayed in Pittsburgh. It wouldn't be in until almost 6:30 that evening. And I said, "Dadgummit, now how am I going to spend 6 hours?" "Oh, no, I'll go down to my favorite bar and talk to Gary. Because that way I can kill the whole afternoon." Well, if you got a favorite bar and you know the bartender's first name, and as soon as you come in the door, your drink's up on the bar. And that's exactly what happened. And I looked at that drink and I said, "Well, typical alcoholic statement. One won't hurt me." And as we know, the disease of alcoholism, the allergy takes over. And after I took that first drink, the phenomenal craving took over and ordered another drink. Drank that and the phenomenal ordered another drink. And I managed to make it to the airport, and I picked up that vice president, and I put his suitcase in the car, and I drove him down off that mountain down to the hotel he was staying at, and I got his suitcase out and brought it over, and he said, "Just stop right there, Mr. Titcher, and just I'll take care of my suitcase from here." And he said, "You can go ahead and go. I've seen about enough of you as I want to see." And I blew that job that I thought I was the number one candidate. A good friend of mine got it, and he spent, you know, another 29 years at that job. It was one of the best jobs that anybody ever had. But I kept working at my sales job, and my alcoholism just kept growing moss, just kept getting worse. And I got to the place one day that I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I felt like something was wrong. And so I had a good friend by the name of McCoy, who's a psychologist. I said, I'll go in and see Mac. So I called Mac up, and I said, "Mac, I said, I just got something bothering me. I don't know what it is, and I thought maybe I can come in and talk to you, and maybe you could help me." And he said, "All right, come in at about 3:30 on Thursday." And I said, "Okay." So I went in to see Mac at 3:30 on Thursday. And he said, "Well, go ahead and tell me something about you." And so I started telling him the story, and I talked for almost 3 hours. And Mac would just shake his head. he'd just shake his head. And after it was over, he just looked at me and said, Diz, I don't know what to say, but he said, I got a friend I want to call and I want you to go talk to. And I said, okay. And he said, go on home. And he said, I'll call you tomorrow. Next day was Friday and I wasn't doing anything but paperwork. So he called me on Friday and said, Diz, I got you an appointment down at Dunn Hospital to see Dr. So-and-so. And I said, okay. And, so I knew where that was. I knew there was something about that hospital that I'd heard about. I didn't know exactly what it was. But at 9 o'clock I was there and I parked my car and went into the lobby there. Nobody was there. And I started looking around. And I saw the word psychiatric. Psychiatrist. Psychiatry. I said, oh my God. Mac thinks I'm crazy and he just didn't want to tell me. And I said, oh, well, it just deflated my ego. And finally the doctor came out and he said, Diz? And I said, yes, sir. He said, come on in. And he told me who he was, Dr. So-and-so. And he, tell me a little bit about yourself. And I started telling him a little bit about myself. And he says, yeah, I understand that. I can understand it pretty exactly. And I told him a little bit more and started throwing it away. He said, yeah, I've done that same thing one time or another. And as I told my story, he kept relating to what I was telling him. And all of a sudden, I started getting pretty comfortable. I said, wow, this guy knows what he's doing. You know, real comfortable. So after about 3 hours, about noontime, you know, and I finished up my talk and everything, he just looked at me and he said, Diz, I think you're an alcoholic. I said, oh, hell, I wish I'd crazy. And I just shook my head. I didn't understand. And he said, well, I think you'll be all right. I think all you have to do is go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, oh, gosh, okay. And he said, pulled out one of those rare wins, and he circled one. He said, here's a real good meeting. He said, I suggest you go to that one. I said, okay, and that was going to be on Monday night. And of course, I left him, and I went out, and I did the same thing I always did on Saturday and Sunday, you know. And even Monday morning, I went out to work, and I didn't get back really that night until late. And I got back in my apartment, put my briefcase down, and my car keys, and took my time to do it, and the phone rang. Well, I picked up that phone, said, hello. Said, Diz, this is Dr. So-and-so. He said, where were you tonight? And I said, damn, I thought you all had a police force. You know, I thought you were checking on me. And I started to give him some kind of alibi. He said, you don't have to lie to me. He said, there's the same meeting going to be at the same place tomorrow night. And he said, I suggest you better be there. And I said, okay. Well, the next day I didn't work at all. And I didn't drink at all. And I white-knuckled it all day long. And I went to that meeting. I didn't see anybody when I went in that meeting. I grabbed me a seat about on the third row, and I looked up as the speaker's meeting, and there was somebody up there reading something and somebody saying something. And they introduced this speaker, and he started speaking, and all of a sudden I see a fly flying around. I'm watching that fly, seeing what's going on, and pretty soon I'm looking out the window and seeing something going on out there. I didn't have any discipline at all as far as my discipline to pay attention. And every now and then I'd come back to that speaker and hear something he'd say. And my attention span was probably about 3.5 minutes. But anyway, as I sat there, I kind of looked down at the end of the row down there, and there's that psychiatrist down there. I said, I'll be damned, he's in AA too. I said, wow, okay. So after everything was over and they did the Lord's Prayer, I walked over to where that psychiatrist was. And he said, Diz, how are you doing? I said, I'm doing okay. He said, you don't look very good at all. And I said, well, I'm not doing very good. And he said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to the grocery store and get you a big jar of honey. And every time you feel like taking a drink, take a big tablespoon of that honey. I said, okay. And that's what I started doing, you know. I went through two of those great big jars of honey in about 2 weeks. But Believe it or not, I hadn't taken a drink. And there was something about those meetings I liked now. My attention span was getting about 10 minutes. And every time I'd go to a meeting, I'd get about 2 minutes better. And so I went to meetings for 14 months, you know. I heard what you all said about working the steps. And one night I got there early and looked up on that wall and I worked them steps. It took me about 20 minutes. And I said, okay, got that done. And so I just felt like I was doing okay. I was doing what you all said. So one Monday night I go to a Monday night speakers meeting. And after the meeting I'm talking to a couple guys I know. And all of a sudden I feel a tap on the shoulder. And I turn around and look, and there's this old man standing there. He said, your name Diz? I said, yes, it is. He said, well, my name's Slick, and I'm your new sponsor. I said, who said so? He said, see those three guys over there? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we drew straws, and I lost. I just about went off on him again because that was my nature. I didn't put up with too much from anybody at all, but something this time told me to shut up and listen. And I said, okay. And he said, why don't you come over to my house at 2 o'clock Sunday? And I said, okay. And this is where I live. Told me where he lived. So I said, okay. So I went over to his house on 2 o'clock Sunday, and he met me at the front door, took me in the kitchen, had one of these coffee pots perking on the stove, one of those coffee pots. He had a white porcelain table with big white chairs around, big wooden chairs around it, and just beautiful looking. I had a seat, and he had these big, heavy porcelain coffee cups, you know. And he poured me a cup of coffee, and poured him one down, sit down, and he started telling me about himself. And I'm sitting there listening to him tell me about himself. And as he told me his story, I started telling him a little bit about myself. And he would tell me a little bit about him. Then I'd tell him a little bit about me. And it kind of got a contest there because he was doing this and I was doing that. He was doing it. And after about 2 hours, you know, we just pretty much knew about each other. And he said, well, that'll be about all tomorrow. He said, that'll be about all for today. He says, I'll see you next Sunday. He said, next week, bring your big book. I said, okay. So I felt real good about that. And I said, boy, this is going to be all right. He and I are going to get along real good. So I could hardly wait till the next Sunday to go in and see what we was going to do. So I pulled up in front of his house, 2 o'clock, came up. He met me at the front door, put me in the kitchen. We had that coffee pot on the stove. Have a seat, put me a cup of coffee. We sat there and he sat down. He says, open your book up. I opened the book up, said, what do you see? I said, nothing. He said, yep, that's about all you know about AA and alcoholism. And I said to myself, I don't think I'm going to like where this is going. But I said to myself I'd stick it out. And then he said, so he started going through the book with me. He started feeding me, spoon feeding me this program. He got to the preface and told me about the preface. He said that this book is a basic textbook for all alcoholics. He said, you know what a textbook is? And I said, well, yeah, I went to school. I graduated from college. I know what a textbook is. He said, well, what's this one do for you? Damn, it's a tough question sponsors ask you right off the bat. And I said, I don't know. He said, well, textbooks need to be studied. You don't read them. You read magazines, you read newspapers, but you study textbooks. And you study this for two reasons. You study it for the information in here that's going to help you recover from alcoholism. And the second reason you study it, so you'd gather that information so you can help another individual from the same disease. Okay. They said, turn to the forward of the first edition. I turned to the forward of the first edition. He said, read that first sentence there to me. And I said, okay. He said, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. He said, didn't say a word about alcohol in there, did it? No, didn't say a word. He said, well, see, that's your problem. Alcohol has just a little bit to do with it. He said, you have a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. He said, I'm going to show you. And he turned to page 30. He said, now read that second paragraph to me. It said, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And I said, he said, you understand what that means? And I said, well, fully means completely.
Yeah.
And I said, concede, because I was a history major. I know what concede means. That means surrender. He said, yeah. And he said, how about the rest of it? I said, our innermost selves? I said, you know, I started that. Is that in my mind? He said, no way. He said, if Bill Wilson wanted you to take this, accept this program in your mind, he'd have put in your mind down there. But he said, your innermost self. He said, where's your innermost self at? And I said, well, it's right here. He said, that's right. He said, that's where you have to accept your disease, in here, because that you can accept all kinds of tragic events here. That's where you feel good things and bad things. I said, okay. And he said, turn to page 55. You turn to page 55, and he said, read that second paragraph to me right there. And it says, I like to quote it exactly. It says, actually we're fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or another is there. And he said, when you were born, you know, God made you as perfect as you're ever going to be. And you've taken it and you've really screwed it up. You put all these calamities in your life. You put all these pompous things that you want to do, all this grandiosity in your life. And the worst thing you did, you put to worship other things like alcohol. And he said, God hadn't been able to work in your life at all. You know. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, now turn back to page 52. And in fact, back to page 52, he said, I want you to look at your 8 human problems of all alcoholics. And he said, get a piece of paper. Got a piece of paper out. He said, the first one there, we were having trouble with personal relationships. He said, you're having trouble with personal relationships? I said, uh-huh. He said, write them down. Who are they? I put down ex-wife, you know, father, mother, brother, sister, a few people I work with, a couple people in the community, a couple friends, you know. He said, oh, yeah, by the way, you better put God down on there, too. I said, all right, so I put God down on there. And he told me, he said, I want you to go home now, and I want you to really go over all these 8 human problems that you have in your life. And I want you to write them down. The second one is, we couldn't control our emotional nature. And my emotions were completely bent out of whack. You know, I didn't know whether I was happy or sad or depressed or whatever. He said, write them down. I want you to look at them. The next one was, we were a prey to misery and depression. Oh boy, there's a couple biggies. And he told me, you're going to be depressed because alcohol is a depressant. And he said, the only reason we don't want you to go there is we want you to be able to do something about it. So write it down. How many times you've been depressed in the last 6 months? How many times you've been miserable the last 6 months? And I had to write those things down and look at them. The next one, we couldn't make a living. They said, that doesn't mean hold down a job. He said, that encompasses everything you have to do with living. Paying your bills, you know, visiting your kids, being a good neighbor, being a good friend. Doing things like that you normally do in living. That's what you got to put down here. Put down all the things that are not very good in your life. I said, all right. How about you had a feeling of uselessness? Boy, there's a biggie, huh? And I put that down about 6 or 7 times in the last 6 months. How about we were unhappy? How about we were full of fear? And he said, last one was we couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. I kind of argued with him on that a little bit because, you know, when I was drinking, I didn't want to help anybody because I had a love affair with alcohol. And that was the number one thought in my mind all the time. But anyway, I addressed all these 8 human problems and we talked about them the next time we got together. And he just wanted to make sure they was fresh in my mind. He said, that's about all step one. And he said, step two, so I want you to turn to page 45 in the big book, and he said, read this first paragraph here. It says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. He says, See those squiggly writing there? He said, anytime you see squiggly writing in this book, it's very important. And it's power greater than ourselves in squiggly writing. He said, obviously. And he said, but where and how were we to find this power? Well, the answer is in the next sentence. It says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. It doesn't say help you solve your problem. It says it will solve your problem. And then he said, turn the page. And when you read here, it says, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and even express a willingness to believe in a power greater than self, we commenced to get results. And I said, wow. I didn't really start believing in a power greater than myself. More, I started believing in the power of the fellowship. And believe it or not, when I started believing that, I started getting some good results. And he said, read the next page. He said, do I now believe or am I even willing to believe there is a power greater than myself? As soon as man can say he does believe, is willing to believe, he emphatically assure him he is on his way. I found out that there's a process in this book. And it's an equation. You got to be willing. And if you're willing to believe, and you believe that you can get sober, and you believe that you can find a better way to live, if you make a decision on that belief and take action on that decision, you have results. And from the results, you have faith that your original belief was true. And Bill goes on to prove that on page 51 because he put three people in this book, three proper names. He put Columbus, Galileo, and the Wright brothers. Now, you got to admit to yourself that all those people had a belief. Correct? Now, those Wright brothers, most people thought were sniffing glue because these guys thought they could fly. Now, really. So anyway, what they did, they called the Weather Bureau in Dayton, Ohio, and found out where the best winds were in the United States. And they said, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. So they put this apparatus they built, this old, by the way, they were bicycle mechanics. That's the other thing that was kind of doubtful about them. And so they put this apparatus that they had built in their bicycle shop on a truck, and they took it over to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and they found a high sand dune over there, and they built this catapult that came down off this sand dune, and they took that apparatus on the top of that sand dune. Old Orville got in that thing, and they cut him loose, and it came down that catapult, and he went up in the air like that, and he flew for 219 feet. You know, nobody believed that they fly. The newspapers wouldn't even publish it. But you see their belief. They made a decision. They took action. They got results. And they had faith they could fly. Now, Galileo is a little bit different. Galileo taught at a university in Rome. And he was a great teacher. He wrote a paper, the Laws of Falling Bodies. And in that paper, he said that the sun was the center of the universe. Well, the church, who governed everything at that time, said, no, you're wrong. Copernicus and Aristotle said that the earth is the center of the universe. And they said, you're under house arrest. And they locked him up for over 55 years. But his students believed in what he was teaching them. And they went out and they convinced the world that the sun was the center of the universe. And the church family took it under consideration. They relented and they said, Galileo is right, Aristotle, Copernicus is wrong. They let him off of house arrest, but that time he was an old man. But he got to enjoy his leisure life. Now Columbus had a belief too, right? He believed the earth was round. Now, it was kind of crazy, too, but he also said that he could get east by going west. That's another one of those things that people had a tough time believing in. But, you know, there's a good chance that maybe Columbus was the first alcoholic ever written about. Well, when he left Spain, he didn't know where he was going. And when he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he came back, he couldn't tell anybody where he'd been. And he did it all on somebody else's money. But anyway, Bill tried to prove to us about believing. And that equation and the people he put in the book was it. When we get to step three, I'm sorry. When I finished step two, Slick said I had to read. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, that's our alcoholism is going to get us one way or another. We can't get out of it. He said we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or he isn't. He either is or he's not. What is your choice? And he said, you can't make this decision in 15 seconds and move on to step three, because if you do, you're going there with Steph Will. He said, I want you to think about this as many times a day as you can and get that in there and make sure this is the way you believe. And so I had to do that. And I had to fearlessly face that proposition. And finally, I believed that really God was in charge. And so I went to step three, and that's on page 60. And it says, page 60, being convinced we were at step three. Well, what are we convinced of? Well, right above that's the ABCs. A is step one, B is step two, and C is step two. So we're convinced of the A, B's, and C's. That's step one and step two. So it says we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God. Over to God as we understand him. Well, you know what your will is, dear? No. You know what your life is, dear? No. He says your will is the way you think. And your life is the action you take on your thinking. He said, that's what we got to change. He said, if we can change the way you think and the action you take on your thinking, you're going to have a better life. So he says, there's two questions after that that nobody pays any attention to. It says, just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? Well, just what do we mean by that in the next four or five paragraphs. It said that any life won on self-will can hardly be a success. And further down it says, each person like an actor who wants to run the whole show. You know why he put the word actor in there, Diz? No, he didn't know your name. And so we went through the whole things, and everywhere it said his or he in there, I had to put my name in there. You know, like down this one part. Diz may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrifice. On the other hand, Diz may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, Diz is more likely to have varied traits. Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. That's exactly the way I was. Some days I was, some day I wasn't. Well, just what do we do? Turn the page. First of all, we had to quit playing God. Simple as that. It says it didn't work. It said next, we decided, here's our decision, that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be the director. He's the principal and we are his agent. He's the father and we are his children. You know, the director runs the show, not the actor. The actor is part of the show. Let the director do the directing. And so therefore we had to get somebody else in charge. This goes through and gives us some promises over on page 63, but then Bill writes one of the most beautiful prayers of any prayer that's ever been written, in my opinion. And that's the third step prayer. It said, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. The hook in there is to relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Get me out of me and I don't have a bad life. Let God do the work and let me do the following and everything's going to be okay. And it says, now this was only a beginning. It said, next we launch out on a course of vigorous action. And this is a four-step inventory. And the book says a lot of beautiful things in here. Bill compares a business inventory to a personal inventory. When I took a lot of business inventories, being in a department store, every January 1st, we had to inventory everything in the book. So it says we had to look at unsaleable goods. And Bill suggested we do the same thing in our life. Look at unsaleable goods. And he's looked for down a little bit further. He said we had to consider what defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. And Bill in 1937 and 38 said there's three common manifestations of self. Resentments, fear, and sexual misconduct. And he said resentment's the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. And he gave me this sheet of paper and said I had to put down my resentments on there. Who did I resent it? Ex-wife, you know, same thing almost. You heard me do it for some friends. It also said, you know, we had to look at institutions. Well, I had a few of them down there, too. I didn't get along too good with the police department. You know, I was in court more than my lawyer was. The one thing I like that Bill wrote in here is he says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. And Slick was a great believer in this book. He said this. He said, if you feel bad physically, you go to a doctor. And you tell the doctor what's the matter with you. He examined you, and pretty much if you're right, you know, that he'll prescribe something for you, and it's going to make you better. But, you know, that don't help you mentally or spiritually. He said the same thing with you mentally. He said if you have to go to this therapist or a psychiatrist, and you tell them what's the matter with you, pretty much they can give you something to do, and it'll straighten you out mentally. But that's not going to help you physically or mentally. But he said, when you get your life straightened out spiritually, it seems like that the other two just come in place. And you know, he was exactly right. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. I had to look at my resentments, and I put them down on there. And he also reminded me to make sure I put God down on there, and I did. And I looked at that second column, why I was angry at everybody. And I missed about two or three things on everybody. And I had to check mark how it affected me. My self-esteem, my financial security, my ambitions, my relationships, including sex, etc. And then he told me, he said, Diz, in order to get through all these things, you've got to pray for each one of these individuals you've got on this list. And boy, I didn't like to do that. He told me how important it was, you know, to pray for these individuals and these institutions. And I had to do that. And he points this out on page 66 and 67. And then he comes down. He said, now here's the last thing you got to do. You got to look for your faults. He said, in each one of these resentments you have, where were you selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And normally in each one of those things, I could find at least three of those things that I was in each one of those resentments. And he said, this is the only thing you can change. You can't change the first three columns at all. You can only change your mistakes in these things. And I said, okay. He said, the second thing I want you to look at, your fears. I listed my fears. I listed 66 fears. Now, I want you to go back on page 62 because it says, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Why is that the root of our trouble? Read the next sentence. Driven by 100 forms of fear. That's why I'm selfish and self-centered. Now, I only knew 66 of them. I didn't have 100. But anyway, 66 was enough to make my life completely wacko. But I handled each one of those, and I put them down on the form, and then I asked God to remove the fear and showed me what I could be. That's what the book asked me to do. And then I got into looking at my sexual misconduct. And I did the normal, same things that everybody else did to themselves. You know, I had sex with a married woman. I had sex while I was married. I had a one-night affair. I did all those things, and I listed all those things. But there's one thing that came up in that inventory that I really had to look it up, and it says over here on page 69, it says, did we unjustifiably arouse bitterness? And I look back in almost every relationship I had, whether it was female or otherwise, that I left in bitterness. And I had to go all the way back through all my inventory and look at every relationship I ever had. And if there was some bitterness that I left in that, I had to address it. I had to put it down on paper so I could look at it. That was a biggie with me. When it came around to admitting to God myself, Slick told me what I had to do about that, and I did it. And he said, now the other human being, he said, I want you to call Clarence. Clarence was his sponsor. He's one of those three guys that was standing over there. And Clarence had about 29 years. Slick had 22. So I called Clarence up, and I said, I'm supposed to come up and do all this fifth step with you. He said, okay. He set it up. And so I went to his house, and And we went into his study there, and I started talking about all these things and trying to get, you know, all the resentments and get rid of everything that I could. And when I got halfway through, he stopped me and he said, "Diz," he said, "I don't understand why you're resentful at God." And I said, "Clarence," I said, "you know, when I was 17 years old, I said, 18 years old, I remember I used to go to about 8 or 9 churches looking for God, and I never found him. All I found was some guy up there talking about something." I said, "never one time found him." And I said, I've looked for him all my life. And it's just, he never would come into my life and never do anything for me. And he said, "Diz, you got it all wrong." He said, "In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a very polite God. He doesn't go anywhere he's not asked." And he said, "you haven't asked him. You've been trying to find him as if he was lost." And said, "all you have to do is just ask him to come into your life. And you'll be surprised how many remarkable things are going to be happening." And I said, "wow." So after I finished it, I went back to Slick and told him everything that went on. He agreed with me and he said, "all right, now how about your character defects?" I said, "well, I got a list of them." And he said, "well, let me tell you something." And he did. He told me something very profound. He said, "the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are the exact opposite of all your major character defects." He said, "you can turn your fear into faith. You can turn your hate into love, your ego into humility, your anxiety and worry into serenity, your complacency into action, your denial into acceptance, jealousy into trust, fantasizing into reality, selfishness into service, resentment into forgiveness, despair into hope, loneliness into fellowship." And he said, "you don't have to go any further with your character defects." And I said, "okay." Step 7 is very important to me because something popped up at me there. And I had to talk to Slick about it. It's, "grant me strength." And I said, "strength? Slick, where am I going to get this strength?" He said, "Diz, look at what you've done. You've looked at all your human problems. You know, you've taken an inventory of all your resentments and all your fears and all your sexual misconducts. You even put down all your character defects. That's where you're getting your strength from. And if you can get that strength, you're going to go from here to there and do God's will." And he said, "it's very important you go into step 8 with God's will rather than self-will." He said, "if you don't, you're not going to be able to make your amends." And so when I got to step 8, he said, "you got a list of all your amends. You did it when you made your step 4. And I said, "okay." He went up to the 12 and 12, and there's a paragraph in there that told you how you should divide your amends up. The people you can get to right now, and the people you can get to next, people you can get to later, and if there's anybody you never have on there, to put them on that never list. And that's what I did. And he was exactly right, because those people I could get to now, I got to very quick. That next list move over, and I got to them, and I got to later. It took me about 6 or 7 months, and I was going back to West Virginia one day, and Slick came over to one of the meetings I was going to. He said, "hey, I hear you're going back to West Virginia." I said, "yeah." He said, "there's something I want to talk to you about." And I said, "what's that?" He said, "this thing about your ex-wife." And I said, "all right." He said, "Diz, did you realize when you call your ex-wife how bad that makes you look?" And I said, "no." He said, "I've been watching you. Every time you talk about her, it's very derogatory." He said, "why don't you find out a better name for her?" And I said, "well, like what?" He said, "well, why don't you call her your former wife?" And I said, "okay." And you know, he was exactly right. I started calling her my former wife, and things got better. He said, "by the way, if you're going back to West Virginia, you might bump into her, won't you?" And I said, "I don't know whether I will or not." He said, "well, if you do, you're going to make amends to her?" And I said, "well, yeah, if it comes up, I'll be sure to do that." He said, "okay, do that." Of course, I was hoping I wouldn't get to see her. And so when I went back to West Virginia, I did. I went to my daughter's house. She had this big thing going for one of her daughters. And I went in and saw everybody and said hello and everything. And as soon as I walked in the kitchen there, she stood, you know. And she was talking to somebody. And I just said to myself, "okay, we better get this over with." And so I walked up to her and I asked her how she's doing. She said, pretty good. I said, you got a couple of minutes I could talk to you? And she said, yeah. I said, would you mind going outside? And she said, no. So we went out back on the back porch and I said, listen, you know, I said, there was many unhappy things that happened in our life when we were married. And I just want you to know that I take full responsibility for my action and all those things. And I don't hold you responsible for any of them at all. And the one thing I'd really like to do, I'd like to have a better relationship with you. And she said, okay. She said, that'll be fine with her. Now, Slick told me something else before I left, just in case I got to see her. He said, after you make her amends and she says, okay, I want you to ask her if there's anything she'd like to say. And I said, well, is there anything you'd like to say? And for the next 25 minutes, she told me about things that happened in her life that I had forgotten about. Well, I never knew it had happened. A couple of times I had to look away because it was so harmful to me, painful, and I had to relive all those things. And like I say, she went on for 25 minutes. And after she was finished, I looked at her and I said, thank you very much. And I was able to go back and enjoy the afternoon. I had a better feeling of what this fellowship was really about. Because it's not only about amends, it's about everything else. Now on page 8, Bill writes something that's very important. I think people just kind of look over it. He says, I'd like to be called the catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence. And Slick told me that our three dimensions of existence was physical, mental, and emotional. And he said the fourth dimension of existence is the next line. It says, no happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And to me, that's step 10, 11, and 12. Oh, gosh. Don't worry, James. So when we get up to step 10, beautiful writing Bill Wilson does again. He says, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Fourth dimension of existence. He said, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I'm learning more and more about this fellowship. I'm learning more and more how effectively make it work. He said, I've got to continue to look for steps 4 through 9 on a daily basis. And if I do, and if any of these came up, then I have to turn my thoughts to somebody that I can help. And then he puts a slogan in here that Dr. Bob was famous for. Love and tolerance of others is our code. He pays tribute to his co-founder. He also gives us our sanity back in step 10. Now we can start thinking with our will, the way it should be thought with. And then all of a sudden he gives us some more promises. And one of the promises that says, instead, the problem has been removed. And then we go down and we find out that we get our willpower back as long as it's in line with God's will. Very simple. Well, if I'm operating with God's will, I'm doing a pretty good job right now. Step 11 to me is 21 spiritual exercises that I must do when I get up in the morning until I go to bed at night. I do these things on a daily basis. When I get up, there's about 8 or 9 things I got to do. As I go through the days, there's about 4 or 5 more I got to do. And when I retire at night, there's about 7 or 8 I got to do. And I do these things on a daily basis. There's another hook in that 11th step that people might pass over. It says, after making our review, we ask God for forgiveness. Slick says, you can't ask God for forgiveness unless you have forgiven all those people that you have harmed in your past. And I had to take a minute and go back and review all my past behavior and see if I have done that to all those people. And after I told Slick, I think I have. He said, all right, then you can go to God and ask for forgiveness. And he said, now just don't do it lightly. Spend some time with that and make sure that he grants you forgiveness. And I did. I spent a lot of time like that. Went on to step 12, having had a spiritual awakening. As a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, practice the principles in all our affairs is an easy one because Bill wrote three more chapters, one about wives, a family actress, and two employers. So that's what I had to practice in. You all heard Nancy talk today. You know, I'm married again. Nancy and I are married. We've been married for 23 years. We do a lot of things together. One thing I try to do for her is that she still works. And when she gets off at 4 o'clock, I'm trying to be home there for her. I don't try to be a gone anywhere. I always try to be there when she gets home. Sometimes I'm asleep in my chair, but, you know, she wakes me up. And that's what I try to do for her. Our relationship as a married couple, we do things together. We support one another in what we do. She goes to see her mother. There's not much for me to do, so I don't go. I go to many all AA conferences and talk. Sometimes she don't go. So we trust each other to do that. That's what we build up before us in all this. This is what the AA program has given us. You heard her talk today about trust. The family afterwards, well, I'm the last of my generation. I'm the patriarch. I have nieces and nephews. I have two sons and a daughter. And I've got to be a father and I've got to be an uncle to all those. I try to do that. I don't try to interfere in their lives. I never will do that. But I try to let them know that I'll be there for them if they need some help. And I support them in whatever they try to do. And I think I do a pretty good job. When I don't work anymore, so two employers, I've made amends to a few of my employers. I made amends to some of the people I work with. So when I look at that chapter and read that chapter, I think I've done a pretty good job. Come back to carry the message to alcoholics. When I was about 3 years sober, I was giving a talk on one Wednesday night. And after the talk, people come up and thank you for the talk and appreciate you being here and all that. And all of a sudden, this little girl comes up there and she's got a baseball cap on. She said, I really could relate to some of the things you talk about, and I want to know if you'll be my sponsor. Let me get back to you on that. And I got her phone number and her name, and I didn't know what to do. So it was too late to call Slick because I knew he was in bed. So the next day I called him up and I told him what had happened. He said, well, come on over here. I want to talk to you. And he says to me, he says, I told the problem what had happened. He said, well, I want you to turn to page 60 and I want you to read that step to me. I said, having had a spiritual awakening, there was all these steps we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. Stop. Read that last sentence to me. I said, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. He said, all right, do you understand what that means? And there's one of those questions. You got to watch what's said. I said, yeah, I think so. He said, there's no thinking about it. He said, you carry the message to alcoholics. And whether that's women, black, kids, or whatever, you got to carry the message to alcoholics. And that's what we've been working on for these 2.5 years. He said, that's what you got to give away. And I said, okay. So I went home and called that little girl up and said, I'll be glad to sponsor you. And found out where she worked. And we found a place where we can meet. It was in a park on a picnic table. And we sit there. And I went through the big book with her just like Slick went through it with me. Her name was Sue. And she came out there and she did a good fifth step. She made her amends. She did real good. She called me up one day and she said, I've been asked to go out on a date and I don't know what to do. And I said, well, what are you going to do on the date? He said, he wants to take me to a movie. I said, Sue, you're going to go to a movie, and that's it. Okay. Called me back a couple weeks later. He said, he wants me to go out to dinner with him. I said, Sue, go out to dinner. Okay. So they dated pretty hot in heaven. Then she got married. He invited her to marry. And I said, what'd you say? He said, oh, I said, okay. And so they got married. I went to the wedding, and they had a real nice wedding. She still worked in AA. But the thing she did, she moved up the road a little bit, about 41 miles. And they were living up there. About 3 years ago, we get a Christmas card. And I look on, it's from Sue. And I open it up and look at it. She gives wishes us a Merry Christmas to everything. But there's a letter inside of there. And I opened up the letter and said, Dear Diz. She said, several weeks ago, I wanted to go shopping down in the big city. Instead of going down the interstate, I decided to go in the back way. As I'm driving down the back way, I passed that park where you and I used to sit on that picnic table. And she said, I stopped my car. I got out. I went over that picnic table. And she said, I sit down there and I reminisced about all those things and all that time that we had going through the big book. And she said, today I want you to know I have 25 years of sobriety. She said, I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, I love you very much. And she signed it Sue. The magic of Alcoholics Anonymous can be found between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. But the miracle of this fellowship is found between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Diz Titcher. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Diz. And now if you'd all join us, close with the Lord's Prayer.